Love and respect is currency in relationships. The more you put into your relationships, the more value they contain.
Okay, so Ned, in the book, you talk about three things that relationships have taught you. What were those three things that you mentioned?
Relationships have made me aware of my triggers, what triggers my emotions. When I'm triggered by something, it kind of gets me to understand a little bit more about myself, and that it happens readily in relationships. You'll be cruising along and your partner will trigger something. And so what I've noticed in my relationships is that, you know, I would bring the past forward in all my relationships. I'd bring the experiences I've had from other relationships into my current relationship, and that would be my triggers. And I would bring hurts that I had from the past, you know, that I hadn't healed. And then again, my partner in front of me may say something and I'd be triggered. So relationships have taught me about what my triggers are. And then that's been a good tool for me to go inward and to look at my past and maybe do some healing and let go of some of the things that I'm hanging on to. Relationships have taught me is how to control my emotions and to respond in a more gentle manner. Because when we're in a cooperative relationship with our partner, it's not appropriate to, you know, constantly be triggered and then to exercise our emotions out on that person. Mm-hmm. It's not fair. You know, it's not fair that, you know, and for me, the emotion that would generally arise, and I think we've talked about this in the interviews already, is that the emotion of anger. You know, my partner would always get the brunt of my anger. They get the brunt of me being an impatient person. Mm-hmm. So relationships have taught me how to control that, my emotions, and how to maybe step back when they're arising.
Something I'm curious about with that, because I can relate to this as well, and I think most people who are listening can, that some kind of, like we were talking about, certain triggers come up. But this is what I'm curious about. When we are fresh and new into our relationships, that's generally a time where they're new and it's exciting and relationships are great and they're fun, and we're also looking for acceptance from this person to see if they will be a long-term partner. But I wonder why it is that once we become more familiar with that person that these things start to come up. And that's because that's been my experience. Is in the beginning, I'm so preoccupied with the fun and learning someone new and getting to know someone new that I'm preoccupied with that. I don't have any, and no triggers are coming up. And it's not until I become comfortable with them that these things start to arise. And what do you, first off, do you relate to that? And secondly, what do you think the cause of something like that might be?
Yeah, I can completely relate to that. I think it may be a couple things. Familiarity breeds contempt, you know. So once you get used to somebody, you start to the things that you find cute in the beginning start to become slightly annoying, and then eventually they just get to be nails on a chalkboard.
Right.
However, there's also, I think, one of the most beautiful things about a new relationship is the level of innocence that comes out of you. When you first start dating that person, you look at them with eyes that are looking, not knowing. Your eyes are looking to get to know them.
Right.
And so you're actually more innocent and in the moment with your partner, which immediately brings up this sense of euphoria. And that's one of the benefits of actually being in the moment and being present. We think it's the other person that's bringing up maybe some of these feelings, but it may be part and parcel of you actually joining the moment that you're in and witnessing the person with innocence. And that's something that I get to later in this chapter in the book is I talk about how to maintain that sense of innocence when you look at your partner.
And that's part of the reason why I wanted to bring that up, because that to me is a really fascinating thing about meeting someone new, is that it's almost like you're looking for acceptance. Once you cross the finish line and they've accepted you, then you somehow let down the guard, and then the things that might be disruptive in your spirit start to really come forward. And that's something that I've always noticed with relationships that I've ever been involved with, but even if it's just friendships, that sometimes once I feel like I've earned their acceptance, it's almost like I'm subconsciously challenging them. Or some people have even said to me this, that it's like they're subconsciously trying to sabotage the relationship with those triggers, as you say. Or I don't know. I don't know exactly where I'm going with that, but that's something that I personally have noticed a lot, and I've been told this, and I've seen other people do it, you know, where they almost sabotage the relationship, the things that are inner conflicts with them, and they're challenging the relationship. But yeah, like you said, we'll be getting into that later so that we can look at our partner like it's the first time, which is, everyone knows the magic in that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think sometimes we unconsciously seek to find ourselves in others.
Mm-hmm.
So the relationships that we're drawn to will be ones where we see ourselves more clearly. And then the thing about that is that the relationships that mirror back parts that we don't like about ourselves, those are some of the most beneficial relationships we can have, because they're really just in showing you, you know, where you need to maybe apply some healing, or what you need to look at in yourself.
So what was the third thing that you learned from relationships?
They've taught me to see a connectedness between myself and others. And that was sort of the deeper portion of what I learned in relationships. I didn't get to that until I started to get over myself. I had to get through a good chunk of my healing. I had to clear my ego out, so to speak, and be able to look at my partner a little more deeply. And then I started to see more and more of myself.
Mm-hmm.
One thing I remember, and I'm not sure if we got to this in the love chapter, but when I used to look at my partner, I used to think I was getting love from them. What I realized when I went further into relationships and explored love in relationships is that when I looked at another person, the love that I was feeling was my own. And so the person you're with, you know, sometimes becomes a mirror for you to see yourself more clearly. And I thought that this person loved me dearly, but they really actually didn't. I loved them very dearly. And that was a huge epiphany in one of my relationships I had, is that the love I was seeing was really just my own love.
That's kind of an interesting concept. And I don't think we did touch on that in the I'm Love chapter. I think that's the first time that you mentioned that. But I could see that being something that would keep a relationship going that isn't really healthy.
Mm-hmm.
If you're seeing, like, you know, it sounds like if you're able to do that, well, you got your shit together, but it's possible not to be able to see if they love you or not, if you love them. That's mm-hmm. kind of an interesting concept.
That relationship was actually a codependent relationship that I got into. And yeah, it was a really difficult experience for me. But it was a great experience in the way that I learned a lot about myself.
Mm-hmm. Now, another thing I'd like for you to discuss is what kind of advice you have on identifying your triggers and managing their negative effects.
Well, here's the thing, is that triggers are generally more, they're information. So how we identify a trigger is when our emotions start to spike. Okay. So we'll be kind of going through our day with our partner, and then all of a sudden our emotions start to get overactive. And this can be happy, sad, angry, all points in between. Mm-hmm. So that's how we start to identify, is to be conscious enough to catch what's happening in you, mm-hmm. before you go into a reaction. So if you can catch a trigger on the onset, then now that trigger is information. You can take stock of what's just unfolded around you, and then look at and ask yourself. So if you're walking through the mall and you notice that your partner glazes over at another person, of the opposite sex, and you suddenly feel angry or jealous, at that moment, you can either go into what you feel and project that onto your partner, or you can look at yourself and say, why do I feel emotional about this scenario? What's hurting from my past? What am I hanging on to from my past? So triggers, they really do let us know, you know, where we need to heal ourselves. And that's one of the biggest takeaways from a trigger, is being able to just pull yourself back and take a look at yourself.
The other thing too is, so that's a scenario that's pretty common. You hear about people who are jealous of some spouses are so controlling that they won't even let their partner go out for a night out if there might be other people there that might make them feel like their relationship's being put at risk or something like that. But then there's the other situation too, where like life stuff, things that come up in life, like we talked about the money room quite a ways back, or you know, like these different sorts of things, like maybe you're in a lot of debt, or you had a confrontation at work with a coworker. I don't know, you got a flat tire while you're driving to work, or just while you're out and about. Any of these sorts of situations, I find like everything that happens to you personally, you tend to shed that onto your partner. You know, so like whenever something happens to you that's unpleasant or stressful or whatever, that tends to be the person you dump on, because they're within your proximity. Like they're always within your proximity. Mm-hmm. And that's also why I want to know how people can identify, and more like identifying is one thing, but it's managing the blast radius that then can corrupt a relationship. And it might not even be anything in particular that your partner is doing to you specifically. This just might be you in the world. And then you take all of that and you dump it on them because, again, you're comfortable with them. And some people might even say that that's the person that should somehow or another mend you and make you feel better about certain things like that.
Well, I think this is where the second half of this topic of relationships is where we're going to talk about behaviors and relationships that we're having with our partners. Mm-hmm. But I think when you lay down some ground rules with your partner, and they get to learn who you are, they'll know when you're triggered or when you're dumping, and they can just gently remind you, say, hey, you know, what do you need? How can I help you? See, in the past, I would do that. I would have a bad day and I'd dump on my partner. I don't do that in my current relationship. My wife is far too precious to me to be the one that I would dump on. You know, it's not appropriate. It is a behavior that does tend to happen. And, you know, if I'm going to be short with anyone, it could very well be my wife before somebody else. But it's certainly not an appropriate way to manage my emotions. Mm-hmm. But this is where I see relationships a little bit different. And I'm really excited to get into the second portion of this interview and then talk about how I manage my relationship with my wife, mm-hmm. and how we've created a very harmonious flow between each other.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and now another thing that you talk about in the book is trapped emotions mm-hmm. from traumatic events. I would love for you to expand on how that affects our lives, because this is stuff now that could be recent. It could also be something that happened years ago, way before you ever met your spouse or partner, right? And so I'd like for you to expand on the trapped emotions from traumatic events.
Sure. When I first met that doctor that I talked about in the preface of the book, mm-hmm. one of the things he did with me is he took me to go see a shaman. And a shamanic healer, one of the things that they do, one of the types of healing work that they do, is they do what's called a soul retrieval. So the basic idea around that is that when we go through life and we have traumatic events, we sort of leave a little part of ourselves in the past in that event. And then we kind of move forward. And then next thing you know, we go through another traumatic event. Life's going to be full of them. There's lots of experiences in our lives that are traumatic or difficult or trying. And so each time we go through these different events, there's a possibility of leaving a little bit of ourselves in that event, stuck in the past. Mm-hmm. So the job, what a shamanic healer does, is they look into you and they bring back all those little bits and pieces that have been lost in your traumatic experiences. Now, I feel like it's a very valid type of healing. And it's something that, you know, has been of great benefit for me to go see a shamanic healer. I've also discovered that I can do my own healing work and do my own soul, what they call soul retrieval. And, you know, it's sort of a soul retrieval, in their opinion, is like little bits of your soul gets left behind. But I have a little different spin on it, like a more modern day spin. And it's not any more right, it's just different. So I believe that, you know, just a part of our attention is held in the past. And so we have to go back and release ourselves from that drama or trauma that may have happened. So, you know, if you look at people and you watch them, you'll see certain people that have gone through a lot of traumatic events in their lives, and they're sort of like zombies. You know, they trip over things a lot. They're forgetful. Their life is chaos. Mm-hmm. But there's so little of them moving forward, and there's so much of them kind of hanging out in the past. And so every one of these little traumas that we have can create a string to the past. And that's why quite often we'll bring the past into the moment we're in. These traumas are trapped in us, so to speak. Mm-hmm. So you can imagine what a person would look like if you have, you know, traumatic events that happen every year or once a week or whatever in your life. How many strings that would be attached to the past? It'd be very hard to move forward with all that drag from the past.
Yeah.
So the idea is that, you know, we go in and we start looking at our different traumas and start to heal some of that so that we're not dragging that forward. We start pulling ourselves back so that our entire being is moving forward, not just the shell of us.
Yeah, wow. Yeah, that makes sense too, because something I want to mention or add to that is when you talked about people bringing their past into their present moment, I wonder like if that's because they feel a need for resolve. Like, is that them, like if you're so focused on that and you're bringing that into your present moment, do you think that is because they really want it repaired, or they're still really connected to it? Like once that becomes resolved, then they can just move on much easier?
Yeah, there is a need for resolve. bringing it forward into the current, into a current situation is not the way that we do so. Mm. It actually, a lot of the times, if I looked back at my behaviors and how my old wounds were causing me to react, I could look back at it now and say, whoa, that was really out of context. Like, my anger was not necessary in that scenario. You know, I remember going around with one of my friends, and he was just such an explosive person, and his anger was so close to the surface and was ready to come to a boil. And, you know, he'd walk into an auto parts store and, you know, the slightest little thing would just be, he'd be over the top. He'd be so irritated, you know, and just, he would be so willing to just start yelling at anybody in there, and it'd be completely out of context with the situation at hand. Like, you know, if a student's working in there and he doesn't know if they carry quarter inch lock washers, or, you know, it's not the cause for you to freak out.
Right.
You know.
Now, if you had a trauma in your life that was caused by someone else, how do you find the ability and the strength to accept and move on?
Okay, that's a really good question, and I think it's an important question to follow up with what we were just talking about, how we're stuck in the past. To heal ourselves and move on, we have to bring the focus back to ourselves. You know, one of the things I've noticed while I've been in the I sit in my chair tattooing people all the time, like every day. I've been tattooing for 25 years now. So I've had a lot of opportunity to listen to people talk. People will generally tell me things that they're struggling with. And what I notice is that in almost everybody's problems, they talk about other people. You know, there has to be a willingness to turn that attention back to you. Remove the other person from your thoughts. And that's a good chunk of the equation. I didn't share that in my book. It's just sort of something that, you know, it's coming to me now. So I think the very first step in resolving a problem is to eliminate the other person and say, okay, where is this my problem?
Mm-hmm.
You know? One of the things that gets us into the realm of healing very quickly is we have to accept it. You know, I had some problems in the past, from my past, that I was carrying forward for many, many years. And the thing is that I tried to forgive that person because I thought I really needed to forgive. I knew intellectually, I knew it was important for me to forgive. So, but I just, and I would say that I forgave this person, and then next thing you know, I was still angry. And there was a big part of me that couldn't accept, because I thought if I accepted what happened, that it was going to make them right.
Yes.
Or it would not justify the way I felt. And I felt like, you know, why did this happen to me? So when I actually brought acceptance into the mix, there was an instant relief. It was, and I brought acceptance and I said, you know what? This happened. So what? It does, and my acceptance didn't make the other person right. It didn't make what I felt any less significant. It was just me accepting what was happening, that it had happened.
Seeing that what you said, though, about if you accept what has happened, it made them right. That to me is the crux of the biscuit right there. I think that's like where people will have the most difficulty moving on, is if they feel convinced that the other person wasn't right. That's, I think, like, I don't know. I can relate to that in thinking that that's probably why I got stuck and still am a little bit, you know, because it's like, but you're not, you know, and you end up having this argument with yourself. It's not even with them. That's the funny thing, because like sometimes these people we have conflicts, the conflict with them is so bad that you don't even spend time with them. You don't even see them, but you're having a relationship with them in your mind. And you're arguing with them to yourself. Mm-hmm. And you can easily get caught up with that, because then emotions start to happen. And I feel like that's this, like a vortex that kind of keeps you centralized in being angry, and because you're frustrated, because it might be someone that you're avoiding, that you don't want to talk to, and that you don't ever think you'll have the resolve you want because you have no interest in engaging with them anymore. But then there's this one little thing that you know that you think that they think they're right, and you strongly disagree with it, and you can't accept what they do to you. And I think that is something, I know from my perspective, and I'm sure many people's, is that we need to clear our names and feel as if that we weren't wrong. But we also have to stop having this mental argument with someone, because I've had more arguments with a certain person in my head than in real life. So what do you think about that?
That's the truth. That's really the truth of it, Seamus. And that was my experience as well, is that, you know, and when I look at the traumas that I was bringing forward in my life constantly or reliving in my mind, it was because my mind was so focused on the other person. And I watched my clients talk about their wounds, and they want to tell me in intricate detail about how awful somebody is, and at the end of the day, telling of the story brings about no healing. It only keeps you trapped in the story itself. Mm-hmm. You know, it's the story, it's actually the story that keeps the drama or the trauma, either or, alive. It really keeps that alive in you, and it keeps you feeling like, you know, I've been wronged, and this person should pay. You know, it keeps you away from acceptance.
Yeah, yeah. So I wonder, like, can you forgive without acceptance?
I couldn't.
Uh huh.
I really couldn't, and it's not only acceptance that I feel is necessary to bring into the events that you're carrying forward and you can't seem to forgive. I think there has to be a willingness to let go of your anger. So in your acceptance, you're now drawing a line in the sand and you're saying, okay, from today forward, I'm just going to accept that happened. Mm-hmm. And in that acceptance, I'm going to step over that line. I'm not going to replay my anger for that person. Now, I think that was a very crucial step in my healing from events that happened in my past. I just could not move on until I actually accepted. And then the other half of that is when I stopped sending anger.
And that seems like an absolute thing, where you're drawing the line and then you're committing yourself to moving forward and not to dwell in this other thing. Is it possible, though, that the forward momentum is kind of an ebb and flow of a little bit of forward and then a couple steps back, and then like slowly you'll move away from it? But is it normal, or could it be expected that some people might slip a little bit back into their story?
Mm-hmm. Is a really good chance that you will, and I have. Because there's more momentum in that old story than there is the new story. And the new story is that you actually were not harmed in your traumas. Maybe in that moment you were harmed, but your mind has replayed the thing and been way more painful than the experience of the trauma. You know, mm-hmm. It can just keep torturing. My experiences kept torturing me long after they happened.
And just to fortify this is a really important conversation, because like what we're discussing right now, because I can't imagine that there isn't anybody who've had a difficult relationship with somebody that really affects their ability to have good ones with other people. A lot of this stuff kind of sticks to us over time, and it can even calcify into something that's really difficult to shake off, right? And there's a line of text in your book that I just want to add to this discussion here. And you say, you do not require the world to be at peace for you to be surrendered to yours. Mm-hmm. Which sort of now... And this can be difficult too, because what if that relationship was devaluing you to the point where you don't believe you deserve peace? You know, because maybe you've been told that, or you have been made to feel guilty for things that you have contributed to that bad relationship as well, and now you feel like you don't deserve to be at peace with that relationship and to accept and move on and forget about them. Mm-hmm. That's really tricky too, because you may be very conscious of what they're going through, and it can be difficult not to care a whole lot about that.
And again, I think that's the need to project everything outside of ourselves, and there's no healing, or there's no forgiveness, there's no moving forward when all your attention is placed outward. You know, there has to be an inward reflection on your healing. It's not about the other person. You know, it doesn't, like I say, it doesn't make the other person right. It doesn't make the things that have happened to you any less awful or traumatic. I'm not invalidating anybody's experience. Mm-hmm. But when it's relived on a daily basis and brought forward in your life, it's still causing problems in all your current relationships. It's a problem, you know, and to be completely honest here with you, some of this information was sort of, it was happening even while I was writing the book. So some of this information that I learned about healing my relationships started happening while I was writing. Because I was looking deeper and deeper into, you know, forgiveness, acceptance, and when I was writing the chapters of my book, I would throw all the balls up in the air, and I'd ask my soul, tell me about acceptance, tell me about forgiveness, tell me about trauma. And these are sort of the things that started coming back. So I was actually healing myself in applying some of the methods that I was writing about while I was writing them. Isn't that wild? Like, so this isn't something that I've had to work with all my life. Some of the concepts that came out in this book that I'm sharing with you now are relatively new things for me. And I've had to kind of test them out live on the floor and see what the result was. And then, you know, this topic of healing your wounds and how to get there, it was really big. It was really big for me. It helped open up my heart. When I wrote this book, I needed to really go into love. I needed to forgive all the people that I felt harmed me in my life. I needed to really forgive them. And my heart now is just, it's free, because I've applied this to all the hurts that I've had.
Also in the book too, this is something that is worth mentioning. If you struggle with someone or something, make your healing about you and only you. Never place anything in front of your peace. That to me, see, because I've always had this conflict that it's my responsibility to fix someone else because I was involved in the relationship. Think of it this way. If you realize it's out of their means to fix themselves, I would go and try to find the wisdom or find the knowledge, find the ways that I could help them. You know, like I'm going out trying to collect all of these things, and then I'm going to bring it back to you to try to fix what's wrong with you. Because even in a bad relationship, I think it's really possible to see the good in people. And even though they might be difficult and or nearly impossible to have a relationship with, I think it is possible to see like a core piece of them that's still intact And then you wonder, like, if they understood a way to get better, would they accept that? And maybe I could find the answers, you know, for them.
And here's the problem, is that if you're trying to make yourself better by fixing the world, it'll be an endless pursuit that would keep you in constant search of the right answers for everybody. The thing is that we don't put anything in front of our peace. And that's why, here's a concept that's almost always true, is that what bugs you about another person is generally your problem. It's most of the time, maybe not always, but most of the time, what's causing you to react is stuff that you haven't healed from. If you were healed from it, it wouldn't bother you. And I've actually witnessed how certain things used to be really bothersome to me. And when I got over different topics in my life, they don't bug me. When I see it in another person now, it's like, I'm cool with that. Like, if somebody's really angry, it's okay. I'm okay with it. You know, yell and scream, that's fine. It doesn't make me want to kind of hang out and be friends with you, but it doesn't ping on me the same way that it does. And you can see this, like, if you've, say, for example, someone has been cruel, someone was cruel to you when you were a child, you may grow up being protective over people or animals or anyone that's vulnerable. You'll have that extra protection kind of built into you. It's like, no, I'm not going to allow that to happen. That happened to me. I know what that feels like.
Right.
But when you get over and move forward from your traumas, then, you know, your need to project yourself into the wounds of others becomes insignificant or irrelevant to you. It doesn't matter to you what people are struggling with. Like, it doesn't ping on you. You can just be completely calm and collect if somebody else is having a difficult experience. And then that is actually more help than trying to go out there and fix the world so that you can feel better. Because it just doesn't work that way. And if you put anything in front of your peace, at the end of the day, you're just sacrificing yourself. The world does not have to change for you to be surrendered to your peace. Your peace isn't contingent on the world being great. It isn't contingent on having the best case scenario happen in your life all the time. Peace is actually a reality and a consciousness, or the result of knowing your soul and resting in it.
So yeah. Just so that there's no confusion, you're not saying that if someone else has an issue that you can't lend an ear, you can't be of some help to them, but if you are at peace with yourself, you're not going to be hanging on to their baggage. Is that what I'm understanding?
Yeah, like, you can... I think it makes me more compassionate when I don't, and more helpful when I don't fall apart in other people's problems. Or if your problems were being projected onto me and I don't fall apart in the process, I can just maintain a sense of love for you. Which, you know, and even just listening to somebody's problems, if you go into a state of sympathy, or you start to feel other people's stuff, and you go into a place of grief with them, now you're both suffering over the past, and that does nothing for a person's healing. Whereas if you're able to maintain a sense of love in yourself, you call the life force of God to come into the room and to help heal and bring real love and compassion to the scenario.
That makes sense. Because it could be easy to misinterpret that by someone might think, well, you're kind of telling me to be selfish.
And it's actually the opposite of being selfish. It's being selfless. If you have a problem and you're sharing it with me and I take it on, now I'm taking from you. If you have a problem and I don't take it on and I just give love, now I'm giving to you.
Right. Well, that's a great way to clarify that, because I could see there might be some listeners who heard what was said before and maybe feel a little bit conflicted with that, that it might seem narcissistic or something like that. But I understand it because I read the book and I get it, but there might be people that, like what you just said, clarifies that very well, mm-hmm. I think, which is important because
yeah,
you don't want people signing off on something like that because it sounds selfish and maybe they grew up thinking, well, no, you need to care about other people and so on and so forth. And it's a virtuous thing to do that, I guess.
Caring and has more to do with love and compassion, not guilt and suffering.
Yeah.
And that's like, for me, that was my experience in the past. I would just go into, I'd feel bad and suffer with people.
Well, I've had people, you know, shed their woes with me, and it's difficult if you don't have this knowledge and you really absorb it, and especially if you're an empathic person, to feel what they're feeling, and that sucks the life right out of you. Mm-hmm. And then sometimes what that ends up doing is like, I'm going to avoid them because the last time we hung out, they just dumped on me. And it took me a couple of days to like kind of get back from that, because so if they call or they want to hang out, the answer is probably going to be no, because the last experience I had with them was like a little too heavy and a little too much. And I just feel like I'm being drained from them. That could be a common response. And then those people now feel like they're being ignored, and it just maybe fuels the things that is already wrong with them. So I think, like you said, if you have an ability to be compassionate, but remain neutral in some sense, you're not like taking in what they're giving you, but you're giving them something, and you can somehow or another shield that other stuff, then you're unaffected.
Well, I think it's the mindset of not being, trying to be a savior. We're not put in this earth to save other people. We're here to grow and understand ourselves more deeply, but by doing so inadvertently, it will help other people. So it's just a different way to think about it, and it's maybe not part of the common collective idea on how to help people. You know, I have this saying, and this sounds really harsh, but in a world of problems, make none of them your own. That sounds pretty harsh, but that in an empowered place, when I'm resting in an empowered place, I'm not strangled by the world's problems. And then I have the power to maintain a sense of connection with love and with God, and then solutions just readily come to me. And not that I'm a savior. I am not a savior. But I feel like I'm contributing more than most. And it just comes from a place of just listening. What does my heart say to do in this moment? You know, while I'm suffering and going through people's trauma, I'm not listening to my heart. I'm just taking from them.
So there's something that we sort of touched on earlier, and I can't remember what session it is now, but we wanted to leave it to this session. And this is the topic of emotional intelligence. And it's a really, really interesting thing. Can we talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, it's a topic that I've looked very deeply into. And what I'm going to talk about, it comes from Daniel Goleman. It's not my knowledge by any means. And what I would recommend the readers or the listeners to do is to go out and buy Daniel Goleman's book, Emotional Intelligence, Why It Can Matter More Than IQ. That's the name of the book. It is a phenomenal read. There's so much stuff in there that helped me learn to understand and manage my emotions in a much better way. Mm-hmm. So according to Daniel Goleman, emotional intelligence, or EI, is defined by the ability to recognize, understand, and manage your emotions, and to influence and understand and recognize the emotions of others. Your emotions can influence your behavior, and it helps you read others as well. So there's five different components that make up an emotional intelligence: self-awareness, managing emotions, motivating self, empathy, and social skills. And I'll just kind of briefly read through 1 to 5 here. Okay, so self-awareness, the ability to identify what you're feeling and how to respond to your emotions as they arise. A good sense of self-awareness allows you to see yourself the way others see you. Managing emotions. Your ability to manage powerful emotions when they arise. Having control over what you say and do during difficult situations. Motivating self. Your ability to keep going and be a self-starter in all emotional situations. Using your emotions to your benefit. Empathy. Having the ability to accurately read others' emotions and to respond to what is happening around you. Social skills. The ability to manage your emotions in social settings. Having emotional skills that help you with team building skills as well as team participation.
So what would you say is the importance of having control over your emotions? That was, I believe, the second one that you had listed there. What's the benefits that can come from practicing that?
We learn how to respond more appropriately to what's going on. You know, our emotions, when we have control over our emotions become a gift, not a burden. And for me, you know, my emotions were such a burden and a pain in the butt for most of my life. Mm-hmm. It's just like, oh my gosh, I'm friggin' angry and I just can't stop being angry. And I know I keep talking about anger, but that was my deal. I was Mr. Anger. So if we don't have a good sense of our emotions, then they really cut off our ability to communicate. They cut off our ability to connect with other people more deeply and to have meaningful interactions with people.
Something I want to add to this real quick. You've run men's workshops talking to men about all kinds of things. I went to one of them once, and something I want to talk to you about real quick with emotions. And it's not that this is as common nowadays, because I think, you know, society's shifting a little bit and it's becoming more acceptable for men to identify with their emotions and sort of use them, because it's sort of this thing where I feel like if you're an emotional male, somehow you're a beta male. It's like an alpha male is just like, never cry, can hold all the weight of the world on their shoulders, can just trudge through whatever, and emotions are a weakness. Because there might be some men out there that say, well, I don't show my emotions. But I think that there's no way to not show your emotions. I think some people, and men in particular, might be thinking emotions are the emotions that evoke sensitivity to situations, or crying, or being emotional. Emotions, I think men sometimes don't think emotions are actually like when you're perturbed and angry. Are you picking up what I'm putting down there?
Exactly. Yeah, I know exactly what you're saying. And it's how we submit to gender roles. And that's definitely a topic that I used to teach in my men's workshops, is understanding the gender roles that we take on as men and how it can curb our behavior and how it causes us to inappropriately respond to life. And a guy that is not in touch with his sensitive side is a weakling. Hear that? Tough
and
guy.
I agree.
Yeah, and I think, you know, it's only weakness not to be able to accept and or to manage to access all your deeper emotions. So it's actually my superpower. When I learned how to be soft and how to be a gentleman, and that was the name of my workshops, how to become a gentleman.
Yeah.
And the guys didn't dig it. It was not a successful series for me and guys just couldn't get with it. Maybe they weren't ready yet. But
that's the thing, because, you know, if their guy friends are like, hey man, do you want to go fishing today and crush a few beers? they'll be like, oh, no, I'm going to this How to Be a Gentleman series. Like, you're just going to get called a great big pussy. You know, and that's sort of this thing that, happens. Like, I feel like as generations go on, you know, like, I know, like, our parents' generation, like, they're definitely, that's a pussy thing to do. That's definitely where their heads are at, I'm sure, most of them. Not all of them, of course. But I feel like as we evolve as people, as a species, that we'll be more and more accepting of the sensitive side. And it's ironic because that's what, in a heterosexual relationship, that's what women actually find most attractive, is a man that is willing and able to access those emotions and not be concerned by them, like in a sense that
they're embarrassed. Let's add a healthy woman who's in, is in touch with what's good, you know, like women that tend to attract abusive men or need a lot of healing. It's a reflective of their brokenness.
Absolutely. Like even in this, I know we're kind of digressing a little bit here, but sort of stumbled across a little bit of a rabbit hole, I guess. The other thing too, like I'm a stay-at-home dad, eh? And you know, a lot of my listeners know that already, but I had a tremendous difficulty with that in the beginning because it seemed like so maternal. Like now that my son's getting older, I feel like now the dad side of like that side of the parenting is starting to feel more adequate, and it's more, it seems like more of a natural pairing. Whereas when they're newborn, I was fulfilling a lot of maternal needs, feeding him milk and changing his, like I change diapers all the time. But in that beginning stages, I felt like I was doing the maternal duties of what the child needed, which was very uncomfortable for me, incredibly uncomfortable for me. Not only because I was doing a lot of them, but because my wife was not available to do them, you know. So that's like a whole other degree of getting in touch with what's okay as being a man. Like you think like, you know, yeah, you see a sappy movie and you might shed a tear because something hit a nerve. Well, that's like, you know, if we want to compare it to Scoville units, that's Tabasco sauce and feeding your child a bottle and doing all the maternal things. That's like ghost pepper. You know, it's just, it's really, really uncomfortable. I found it to be, and I'm sure like a lot of men probably would. And like, I know my wife, she often will compliment the fact that a lot of what I do for a son, most men wouldn't do because it's so uncomfortable. I think as like, as far as gender roles are concerned, that those are feminine duties. And I grew up with a very masculine father, and you know, and so there's like this massive conflict within me because like for me, I've always tried to prove my masculinity. You know, like that was important to me because I'm not necessarily a handy guy. I've always been this creative weirdo. You know, the things that I found a lot of joy in doing and I tend to excel at are not quote unquote masculine things. They're sort of neutral in that sense. It doesn't matter if you're a man or a woman. Like there isn't like a particular gender stereotypically that excels at those things. So I've always tried to prove my masculinity in some way. And back in the day, it was by being an asshole, for lack of better words. And I felt like anger and dominance was a masculine trait. And because I wasn't really feeling fulfilled in anything else like that, that was masculine, that's the thing I leaned on. I don't know where I'm going with this, but yeah, that's just something I wanted to talk about for a minute, I guess. So where I want to continue from there is how does labeling emotions change the way that we perceive them?
Yeah, this is something that I noticed in myself. When I labeled my emotions, it would generally keep me stuck in one emotion, or it'd keep me stuck in the label that I've placed upon it. When I learned to remove the label off of what I was feeling, sometimes what I initially labeled was not true. And I made a chart with this in the book. And so in the past, I would something would trigger me and I'd just be angry. And again, that was my go-to emotion. But if I looked at the anger, I wasn't actually angry. Like if I got embarrassed, I'd present anger, and then the catalyst was I'd start screaming. Or if I felt sad or annoyed, frustrated, any one of those emotions, I would just express it through anger and I'd be yelling. Mm-hmm. If I felt hurt, I would get angry and then I'd start yelling. So when we label our emotions, sometimes we cut off what's underneath what we're labeling. And we kind of stay trapped in the label itself.
So what I need to ask then in that case is, like you said, if we're feeling something such as sadness, that might not actually be the root cause of the emotion. So how can people gain access to their true emotions? How do we learn about that?
It's by changing your perception of your vantage point in yourself. So when an emotion arises, that you look at it. And instead of jumping on the first feeling that you have about that, when your emotions are arising, and or say you're, like for me, angry, and ask yourself, am I? Or is that true? And sometimes that is enough to kind of turn inward and say, actually, no, I'm a little bit disappointed here. I had an expectation, or I felt I'm actually hurt. Or I'm not in agreement with what's happening right now, and I need to talk about that. Mm-hmm. And we can sometimes clear out the drama out of a situation by being able to pull back and look at what you're actually feeling. Because as I just mentioned a few minutes ago, your emotions are information. They're telling you something. When you have a good control over not allowing your emotions to dominate your experience, or for you to label yourself as your emotions, then you can use your emotions as a tool. And that's typically what I would do in the past. Is if anger came up, I'd say, I'm angry.
Right.
If I was sad, I was sad. Well, you are not your emotions. Your emotions are happening in the body, but it doesn't make it you.
Right, because now you're personalizing. It's just like what you said back with self-violence. If mm-hmm. you say, that was stupid, and then you personalize it to, I am stupid. Could you say something, though, like, that makes me angry, rather than I am angry? Is that a thing?
I think when we frame it in a sense that I feel angry, or I feel frustrated. And so it's not, I'm angry at you. The emotions that are rising are making, this is what I'm feeling. So let's talk about that, you know? And it could be over stupid things like your partner not setting the keys to the car in one place. And now you're screaming at them. Instead, it's a much healthier thing to do. It's to say, look, I'm feeling really frustrated, because that would be a frustration. Not an anger. Anger would be the result, would be how, where we might take that. But the truth of it is, we may be actually just frustrated. So, and that just requires a dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem with doing that is that we take the anger, and then it shoots us into a different place. If our emotions, we get overreactive in our emotions, we have an emotional hijacking. Emotional hijacking is commonly referred to as an amygdala hijacking, but it's sort of changed into what's called an emotional hijacking. But what happens in this piece of information I learned in Daniel Goleman's book, Emotional Intelligence. And this little piece of knowledge helped me out considerably with managing my emotions. It was actually one of the biggest tools that I learned on how to be able to sit back and get through a lot of emotional difficulty. So what happens when we go into what's called an emotional hijacking or an amygdala hijacking is it's the amygdala in the brain is part of the limbic system. And the limbic system is where the brain regulates emotion. So in an amygdala hijacking, the amygdala actually goes into overdrive and it shuts down the frontal cortices of your brain. So when we're talking about people that, you know, they get angry and then they get more angry and, you know, you can't ever bring anything up to help them in their anger because they just get trapped in it. Or if you've had experiences where you start to see red, what happens in that experience is your amygdala is shutting down your logic. The only thing we can access in the brain is the hindbrain or the primitive modes. And that is like the fight or flight mechanism that gets engaged. So that's how fight or flight works, is that our amygdala gets overactive, our emotions get overactive, then the amygdala hijacks the frontal cortices, blocks you from logic, and just throws you in a fight or flight mode. So knowing that little piece of information was monumental in my life, because this is something that I would do repeatedly in my relationships. I'd get mad, and then I'd get really mad. And then I would say and I'd do things that I felt very terrible about. And I would say the most hurtful things to my partner. And then as soon as I came out of that experience, I'd be like, oh man, I feel terrible now because I should have never said that. I don't really mean that. I was blocked from logic. I couldn't see logic in those moments. So if you're one of those people that gets really trapped in your emotions and it gets so overwhelming that you regret things that you say or do in these emotional outbursts, understand that in those moments, your brain is being hijacked. And so what we need to do to help release that is we need to first not talk. That's the very first thing that you want to do in an amygdala hijacking. You got to stop talking because in that moment, you've got no logic. The next thing we do is if we breathe, just start taking in some breaths. Just feel ourselves kind of calm down. And the fastest way to get out of that hijacking is to breathe and go into our heart. Think of the time when you felt loved or when you loved something and just breathe. There's actually a neural pathway that goes from the heart to the amygdala. So That's the fastest way to pull yourself out of a hijacking is by heart-centered breathing. And that's been a real lifesaver for me in my healing and learning how to manage my emotions. So an important tool that I wanted to share with everyone here.
Yeah, that's amazing information. I have experienced a hijacking, and I've been on the receiving end of a hijacking.
Yeah,
and it's awful for everybody. Mm-hmm. And depending, too, like on how extreme the emotions can get, you know, people can become very fearful of you. Mm-hmm. That can have a long-term effect on everyone, especially mm-hmm. like within yourself.
Yeah. And that's why, you know, I really wanted to talk about this experience because it was one that I was having all the time.
Mm-hmm.
I'd get hijacked and I'd just be a mean, awful person. You know, I did that with my partners. I did it with my friends. I did it with my employees. You know, I would play out these hijackings and not have any restraint.
Okay, so what's your opinion on the quality of communication in today's world?
Well, I think there's good and there's some bads. We often people talk and they don't listen. They talk to get to the next thing they want to say.
Mm-hmm.
They're not really taking in what's going on. And if you don't take time to really listen to what people are saying, it cuts off our ability to have meaningful conversations. And then there's the other side of the coin where we're not talking, you know, and it's become sort of people look at you strange when you just strike up a conversation in a drive-thru.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've got this perception that, you know, I talk to people everywhere I go. If I sit down on a bench somewhere and someone's sitting beside me, I talk to them. I want to know who they are. And, you know, we generally, we think that's kind of strange, or we're leery, or we're suspicious of other people. And that's not communicating. There's so much that can be gained in communication with another.
I have a point to that. And this goes back to childhood. I think every kid is told the same thing. You don't talk to strangers. Right? As a form of protection, because parents are worried about their kids getting abducted or whatever, something happening to them. So when you're told that as a kid, and then you spend years of your formative years not ever engaging with a stranger, ever having a conversation with someone that you don't know, that becomes a habit. Mm-hmm. Even planting that seed that the reason you don't talk to strangers is because other people could be bad. Mm-hmm. Now we learn how to place judgments on strangers that they might be really bad people.
Well, here's the irony too, is that if we don't ever talk, we become stranger because we're just caught in our minds.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, do you think there's some validity though to kids? Because that's kind of impossible to get around. Because I don't know of any parent that would say to their kid, "Yeah, yeah, talk to strangers, go up to people and that you don't know and have conversations with them." I don't think that's a common thing in society. Would you say then that it would make more sense to, like, that's fine when you're a kid because you're a kid, but as you start to become an adult, maybe shift out of that mindset?
Well, that's where you teach your kids to order for themselves at a restaurant. You know, and yeah, you probably, common sense would say you teach your kids not to talk to strangers. But when you get into a restaurant and a child decides what it wants to eat, have the child order for itself.
Mm-hmm.
Have the patience to allow your child to make their order. It would make them feel pretty important that they could read out their order. You know, teach, as your child develops and grows, teach them to how to communicate with people more clearly and effectively. And I think that's...
But under the guidance of the parent.
That's right. It's your job to do that. You know, to teach your children how to be better communicators. We need communication. It is one of the most important things in a relationship. Mm. Without communication, there is no relation. We can't get into relations with each other without talking. It's part of that. And, you know, learning how to be a good listener and learning how to be a good talker.
Right.
I challenge every listener out that's listening to this podcast to spend a week not talking. Spend a week listening to people. And when you talk, it's only a question. You're asking a person a question. So instead of talking for one whole week, just listen to people. See how much you learn from your friends. You know, your friends may know things more than you realize. Like, we're sitting here, you and I are doing this podcast, and we're interviewing about my book, Be Love, a book about awakening. But I'm not the only expert here. You've had a ton of life experience. You know, you have lots of valuable things that you're sharing in this communication with us. So that's the importance of me trying to be a good listener to you, because right. I need to validate all your wisdom and knowledge that you're bringing forth in this podcast. So it's just, communication is so important, and it can really bring a sense of, and this is how we start to gain a sense of unity with each other. When you share something with me and I've really taken that in and listened to it, and then I share something back.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Something, this might be, I don't actually expect you to be able to answer this, to be honest, because it is kind of it's sort of a difficult thing, but I'm sure that you've noticed when you have certain conversations with people, because I interview people all the time, and something that I notice is that some people, they don't really give you the space. They'll keep talking and talking, and then when they pause for a minute, they're really only just thinking of how to keep talking. And what do you think are some of the reasons why someone might be like that, where they can't share the floor in conversation?
That's a strong ego. really strong ego. When you can't arrest yourself in a conversation, you know, it's your ego running wild. As I learned to drop my ego, I've become a better listener. You know, what is the ego? The ego is your mind. It's the voice in your head that you think is you. So where does want come from? It comes from the ego. When we get into a situation where we're having a dialogue back and forth, if all I want to do is just insert my dominance over the conversation, it's just my ego coming out.
That's all it is.
Mm-hmm. It is. That's when you arrest your ego, there's you're okay with letting things go.
Mm-hmm. 'Cause I've always considered it, like, from my limited perspective, that I was always just curious to hear what other people had to say.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this might also be because I didn't value my own thoughts or what I had to contribute.
Oh, so that's a different thing, though. When you don't respond to people and you hold back, then that may be a sense of insecurity. That has everything to do with the ego, too. It's in your mind. We're saying we're not good enough, or we don't have anything value to add.
Mm-hmm.
But what I was referring to is when they can't stop talking. You know, I think good conversations, you know, there's some basic etiquette that needs to be followed. You hear as I speak, I leave pauses, I leave breaks. If you want to jump in there, I'm happy for you to do so. Two topics, 2 minutes. You know, when you get bending somebody's ear for 10, 15 minutes at a time, you're taking from them. And it's okay if the person in front of you wants to hear what you have to say and they're really engaged and they're interested, you can go for 2 hours. But if you don't leave any space in that conversation for the other person to jump in, mm-hmm. you're not communicating. And I find that, you know, over the years with being stuck in the chair listening to people, you know, I've been inundated with more conversations than anything.
Sure.
You know, people just want to crank your ear for 2 hours straight, and they walk away and they say, Ned, you're a really great guy. And I'm thinking to myself, how would you ever know? I never said a word.
That's funny. That's quite a thought.
And that's 100% truth right there.
Yeah. I just wanted to introduce that because you said if someone continues to just chatter and chatter and chatter, that's the ego. And then you mentioned that leaving gaps and so on and so forth, that's setting your ego down. So I wanted to present the polar opposite situation where the ego, because now this has been the case with me in the past. If something's out of my wheelhouse and I have no business talking about it, I'm self-aware enough to know that I'm just bullshitting if I'm talking about something I have no knowledge about. So therefore, I'm inclined to listen. Mm-hmm. And there are also times where, and this is in my youth, I would not say anything because I just didn't think anyone wanted to hear what I had to say.
Yeah.
Because I thought so little of myself. And this is the truth.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the other side of the ego. So I want to bring this up because there may be people who are nervous and shy, and then they're thinking to themselves, oh, okay, well, that's a good thing. That means I don't have an ego. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? So I wanted to sort of bring up the opposite side of
sure.
that, where the
yeah.
ego is like beating you down and suppressing you
mm-hmm.
and being a not a confident person. And in the proximity of overly confident people who have larger egos, that makes them feel even smaller.
Mm-hmm.
So I just wanted to make sure that people understand that that's still not a good thing
mm-hmm.
necessarily. If you feel insignificant, that's your ego.
That's still your ego.
Doing that to you.
Isn't that exactly. funny? Like the ego can go two different ways.
Exactly. Now, the last thing I want to discuss really quickly here before we wrap up this session here, and this is sort of a precursor to what we're going to be discussing in the future in the chapter of unity,
mm-hmm.
but I just wanted to throw this little nugget out there, is how do we find unity in our relationships with others?
I think it just ties exactly into what we've just been talking about, is communication. Is the bridge to experiencing unity with another. And what I feel quickens our ability to experience unity with another person is to really deeply know yourself. Unity is almost, it's a consciousness that arises within you. And it opens up when you are more readily, when you're in touch with your soul. And then when you're in touch with your soul and you're communicating with another, there's a good chance that there can be a unity that starts to develop between you and that person.
Right.
You know, you'll see that in friendships where there's just this harmonious flow between two people. I had one guy that used to come and help me tattoo. Like, he'd help me at when I went and tattooed at different events. I used to travel a lot when I first started tattooing. So I'd go up to the military base. My brother's in the military. And so he'd get me into the barracks, and I'd tattoo there for the weekend. Some really great nostalgic memories with my brother and doing those tattoos. Yeah. So I had one friend, my friend Frank. And Frank and I, we started to experience this unity between us. After the first or second time he came with me to help, we didn't need words anymore. We just started doing. He knew what to do and I knew what to do. And we flowed so well together, and we were just in sync. It's almost like we were just one person.
Yeah.
You know? So, but the unity is this beautiful state of consciousness, and it opens up. When you really deeply look into another, you sometimes can see yourself staring back.